Good morning, guys. Harrison, I don't know if I met the rest of you, but it's possible. So I've read your bios. You're an impressive bunch. You're also a really lucky bunch. I'm sure you've heard that from pretty much everybody who's lectured for you if they've spent even an hour in Monterey before they started the class. If they came directly from the airport and into this classroom, maybe they don't know just how great a place this is. But I actually grew up coming here. I'm from California. As you can probably see, I got the memo about casual dress. Which one of us is born in California? I was joking with Fyodor this morning. Pretty obvious. But it's really very nice to be able to do this with my dear friend Fyodor and for Anna and for Monterey and for all of you guys, because you know, it's obvious from my bio, and you probably have some sense if you've done any of the background readings here, or which I hope you have and will, and if you've, as Anna mentioned, you know, watched some of what I do on TV. In fact, I think I'll be doing from the satellite. You never know until like 5 minutes before, but I think I'll be doing Anderson Cooper tonight from the studio here. So tune in if you can, or come just lurk outside the studio. That's always kind of fun. You know, I'm an area studies guy, right? I, as Anna said, I'm Mr. Rodzianski. I don't have a PhD in political science or in history. I've done a lot of history. I suppose you could say I do political science, but you know, I'm not a theoretician of any kind. There's not really a doctrine to what I do. I'm an area studies guy, which means I spend absolutely as much time as I can in Russia and the region. I really, I prize language and cultural knowledge and expertise. Again, not the same thing as anthropology or sociology, but in an experiential way. There's almost something that you cannot quite put your finger on. There's a kind of feel aspect to understanding a place and a people and their experience. You know, there was a Nobel Prize winning economist who once compared the business of foreign policy, and I think even the Kissingers or the Primakovs of this world would agree, to essentially two steps. Step one is empathy. It's not the same thing as sympathy. Empathy is being able to understand the world through another guy's or gal's eyes. Doesn't mean you agree with them. Doesn't mean that you feel for them. It simply means that you understand how they think and feel and why. And then the second step is basically game theory. How many steps out forward can you project based on what you understand that they want and what you want and what they might do and what you might do? And if you can do those two things, you can be pretty successful in managing foreign policy relationships. Now, that might apply for all kinds of other relationships, but I don't think anyone has ever accused me of being successful in those directions, so I won't pretend to provide advice. Since today is kind of our introductory session, I want to tell you a little bit more about myself too before I launch into maybe a 10,000 foot overview of how I think about the U.S.-Russia relationship today, just by way of introduction. I also want to say, I think what we'll do today, I can't tell you exactly how long this lecture is going to take, in part because timing, you know, I've mastered the 30-second soundbite for television. I have not mastered the 30-minute lecture. Sometimes it goes an hour, sometimes it goes 20 minutes. It depends entirely on kind of the audience and on how I'm feeling it. But and this is something that I've kind of adapted for today. So let's see how this goes. But what we'll do is, unless there's like a clarification kind of question, in which case you can just interrupt, raise your hand, interrupt. This is supposed to be a master class, right? We're presuming a lot of knowledge on your part already, and so you have every right to clarify something or ask something that's urgent and burning. But otherwise, I think we'll do as Anna has said. We'll go directly from my lecture into Fyodor's lecture, and then even more than a Q&A, I hope we can just kind of have a discussion setting. You know, I remember the last time I spoke here, which was very explicitly a single lecture. We were around a round table. And I guess, is this the room that you use for the whole class? Okay. Yeah. No, it's fine. It's fine. But let's practice our first kind of first level of empathy skill here and imagine that we are sitting around a table and behave as if we are sitting around a round table. So who am I, and kind of how did I get to this thing called area studies? I mean, a lot of people ask me, Anna made the point about generations, and it is true. I'm part of what I think could fairly be termed kind of a lost generation or a gap generation of Russian area expertise in the United States. Simple fact is nobody was choosing in the 1990s to be a Russia specialist, almost nobody. And there were a whole lot of reasons for that, but it's not worth dwelling on the negative. The positive is, so why did I make that choice? Why did this kid from Northern California, you know, sort of Carter Reagan baby, grown up with earthquakes and, you know, the Battle of the Bay World Series and all, like, why did I decide to study this place that's literally halfway around the planet? I always tell three stories. I'm going to tell you all three of them because I think you find with each layer of them that you see a little bit more about the richness of this really amazing career path I've been lucky to have. So the first is just is sort of coincidence. I was lucky enough in the 90s to get to take a special series of freshman seminars at UC Berkeley when I was a senior in high school. At that time, the Bosnian Wars were raging in the Balkans. And so I took Balkan history with Professor Ronel Alexander, who I still see now at the ASIS, whatever it's now called, the Association for Slavic Studies, enormous annual conference. And that's a very cool thing because she really is responsible for getting me into the Russian studies field. Now, that seems a little bit, especially for those of us really focused on this part of the world, maybe for my mom, you know, Yugoslavia and Russia seem like the same thing, but, you know, you all know that they're really quite different. So how did that happen? Well, so I show up as an undergraduate, having taken a couple of semesters of, you know, Balkan history, being really fascinated by, of course, the current politics of what was going on in Yugoslavia at that time. But also, you know, we read a bunch of the literature from the region, Bridge on the River Drina, if you haven't read it by Ivo Andrić, is really amazing. And then I saw this Serbian Cyrillic, which is not quite the same as Russian Cyrillic, and they would claim that it's the original Cyrillic. And we read some poetry in the Yugoslav language, and I was like, this is so cool. I'm totally doing this. This is what I'm going to be. This is what I'm going to do. So I wrote my college admission essay, kind of broadly speaking about, like, collapse of empires and how I was really interested in studying Yugoslavia. But also, I did mention Russia in the essay. I went back and read it a few years ago. But I get assigned as my advisor, as my undergraduate advisor at Harvard, the one woman, one of the few actually in the United States, who teaches Serbo-Croatian language. And you probably have someone here, right? Yes?
No.
Yes. See, there you go. It's a testament, right? It's an even rarer thing than Russian. And so, you know, we sort of lay out this whole course for how I'm going to become, you know, a Balkanologist. That's actually what they call themselves. It's a pretty strange term. But it's so about that's, you know, late August or September of 1998. And then about a month later, she sits me down and says, Matt, I've got bad news for you. I've just been hired as the chief translator for the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia, which was just then being stood up in The Hague. She says, don't worry, it's a temporary court. It's going to be like a year, and then I'll be back. So in the meantime, you go study Russian. It's kind of like a mother Slavic tongue. Like, there's a lot of similarities. You'll be fine. I was like, okay. I mean, what did I know, right? I was 17. So I go and I start taking Russian, and I think she's still in The Hague, actually. I think now, 20 years later, Ellen Elias Gorsuch, maybe she just came back. So I ended up as a Russianist as a result of that. And that's the sense in which language is kind of a gateway drug, right? I did the, you know, intensive every morning, 9 a.m., you know, like 2 hours, sitting in the language lab constantly with the naushniki. And once you have the language, the way that you can immerse yourself in almost any element of the culture, if you're a music person, you can get into the music. If you're a film person, you get into the film. If you're a history person, you get into the history. And I was into all of those things. But that's pretty different than, for example, my wife, who's also a Russianist, also studied Russian, did, in fact, a master's in Russian studies at Stanford, which is where we met. But she got into it, I think, in a way that's more common, which is to read the literature first in translation. Or the music, or the poetry, the plays, whatever, the operas, and was pulled into it that way. That was the case for my former boss and mentor, Jim Collins. Harrison, you remember him. Totally got into it through Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. I have to confess, I have never gotten to the end of a Tolstoy or a Dostoevsky novel. It's just not my cup of tea. But once you have the language, it doesn't matter. you can choose, right? You can choose to ramp up your skills in the direction of 19th century, you know, court intrigues, or in the direction of Victor Tsoi, which was more my cup of tea, you know, 80s punk. I'm not sure what you call the genre exactly, because it's sort of Soviet punk music. But anyway, so that was kind of the language story. But that's not the full story. There's another layer. My family, people always ask me, right, my name has a Slavic adjectival ending, which is very funny to me. You all speak Russian, so you know, in Russia, I'm almost always presented without the declined adjectival ending, just, you know, SK, Ikrake, and, or E, and therefore, you know, my name doesn't decline and everything, and it's treated as a foreign name. And the funny thing about it is it's just as foreign or not foreign as Fyodor's name, Vaitalovsky, because they're both basically sort of Polish. And the part of my family with that name comes from the Belarus-Polish border region. Other parts come from Western Ukraine, and still other parts from the former territories of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But so in that sense, there is a family connection. But what's important for me is that that connection always had probably the exact opposite connotation than what many people presume when they see that you have a sort of Eastern European last name. So, for instance, for many Ukrainian Americans today, the drive, the passion to become a Ukraine expert or a sort of Russia security expert is about, you know, sort of rising to the defense and the advocacy of Ukraine. If you had asked my great-grandfather, who watched his younger brother shot in front of his face by Reds during the Civil War, or if you had asked my grandfather, who barely escaped with his life, not only from the Nazi invasion, but then afterwards, actually from the then NKVD, MGB, secret police of Stalin's Soviet Union, they would have said, and in fact, I remember my great-grandfather did say this, they didn't want me then, and I don't want them now. I want nothing to do with these people. And so it's actually a kind of teenage rebellion, probably, that I was drawn to this place and this story, excuse me, that my family had wanted to reject so much. And then there's a third layer, and this is what sustains me, because the accident of learning language and the happenstance of family history are important, but by no means enough. That's enough to get you into something. And I think what sustains me is just the objective fascination of this reality, which is, to my mind, if you have any interest in the canon of Western civilization, look, I'm not a sinologist. It is a deep and ancient and rich culture. But if you have any interest in the canon of Western civilization, you cannot not study Russia. Because if you think about the contributions that Russia has made, I mentioned, right, literature, culture, art, science. Sorry. But then, of course, you know, the notion of having saved Western civilization time and again, right? And this is a narrative that we'll talk about in a moment. But at the same time, Russia is a place, when you really get deeply into it, where you live with dynamic contrast. You live with contradiction every day. And sometimes that contradiction is laid bare before your face, where you walk out of a metro station and you have a woman, you know, an elderly woman hunched over in a physical way that you would never have even thought possible, you know, like nose to the filthy pavement, begging you, you know, blessing you, asking you for money. And then there is literally a Lamborghini parked on the sidewalk, right, illegally, of course, right in front of her. And you see the reality, for example, of Moscow today, and that dynamic contrast is just laid bare. But then there are, of course, kind of the greater and deeper and more historic contrasts, where you have the highest highs of human civilization, right, the absolute heights of scientific, cultural, literary, and every other kind of achievement. And then lows of depravity. It's not worth getting into comparative atrocities, but things that you just, you know, your heart rends itself when you see these things. They are just unreal. And even the simple reality of the poverty in which some people still live to this day, at the same time that Russia reasserts itself as a world power. So these are the things that keep me drawn to this topic and to this field. That's sort of the introduction to me. Let me introduce you a little bit to this field that I'm in. You know, area expertise is kind of the general catchphrase. I work at the Woodrow Wilson Center. I run the Kennan Institute, which is essentially the Russia former Soviet program within the Wilson Center. And I like to kind of offer some caveats about what it is that we kind of Washington think tank folks can and should do and what we really can't and don't do. And let me start with the can'ts. So what do we not do? What can't we do? And you'll notice, if you ever watch me on TV, you'll very often see me get questions like, well, why is Putin doing this? What is he thinking? Right? And I will almost always, despite having 30 seconds, slip in 5 seconds of, well, I can never read his mind. But, right? I do not know what he's thinking, but, right? So we don't read minds. And of course, the irony is there are, you know, literally dozens of lovely books out there about Vladimir Putin, right? And his biography, and they'll tell you all these great things about how, well, he got into a fight in the courtyard in Leningrad when he was a kid. Therefore, he invaded Crimea. Fine. That's fine. Look, you be the judge. Is it useful? Is it valid? Is it not? You know, read these books for entertainment. But in my view, that's not what we do. We can't read Putin's mind or anybody else's. Second, we cannot tell Russians what their interests are. There's this famous instance where George W. Bush is coming out of one of his later meetings with Putin, so not the early one where they looked into each other's eyes or whatever, but one of the later ones. And he comes out and he says to his top advisors, including the one who related this to me, he says, well, that man really doesn't know what his interests are. Well, no. In fact, he just doesn't agree with you about what his interests are. And you may not fully understand what his interests are, but he knows exactly what his interests are. So we, especially in the Western expert community, are very bad at assessing for Russians what their interests are. Instead, we really ought to be listening to them when they describe them. And then third, we're very bad at predicting the next crisis, right? This is a business that we're always getting into, right? Of sort of, well, what's coming next? Not just what is Putin going to do next, but, you know, what is the next explosion? What is the next collapse? I think we are pretty much 0 for 100 on that. Our record is horrific. And, of course, if the list started and ended with the coup and the collapse of the Soviet Union, that would be enough, right? That is like the single biggest failure of expert analysis when you had American Sovietologists predicting, you know, as early, actually, I remember this, Jim Collins, who was ambassador in Moscow, was also chargé. He was the deputy chief of mission and therefore acting ambassador in the absence of the ambassador, the summer when the coup happened in 1991. And he took on that responsibility, I believe, in the early spring of 1991. And he always said that when he got his CIA briefing, the absolute best and the brightest, the people paid the big bucks and given access to the black accounts to really know what was going on, doing, what do they call it? They call it the life sciences aspect, studying, you know, the liver spots on Brezhnev's heads and things like that. I mean, these people had been watching the minutiae of the Soviet Union for decades. And they said, sir, you need to understand our prediction is by the end of 1991, we believe Estonia will have achieved limited autonomy. And of course, by the end of 1991, there was no Soviet Union, right? So even in the bowels, don't imagine that there is some secret world of government where predictions are right. And even in the bowels of the most expert of expert communities, we're very bad at predicting. So what can we do? Why do we bother, right, other than entertainment? And some of it, I will freely concede, is entertainment. I hope I can offer some of that to you. Look. Like I said, number one, we have to pay attention to what Russians say, right? How do they define their interests? They almost always tell us. That's the incredible thing, right? This is not, you know, Americans are from Mars, Russians are from Venus, we just can't talk to each other. We can and do talk to each other. You got a real live Russian sitting here who speaks wonderful fluent English. You guys don't even need that. So just pay attention. It's almost that simple. Just pay attention. It's amazing to me how many times Russians will repeat the same things over and over. Americans will somehow dismiss or discount them. And then that is exactly what happens. Exactly what they have said is exactly what happens, and for the exact reasons that they have said. And related to that, right, we can identify patterns, themes, and trends. Right? When do behaviors repeat? When do rationales, justifications repeat? And what do the trend lines suggest as to where things may be going? And then lastly, and perhaps most importantly, in Washington, because government has a very short memory by definition, right? We have political cycles, we have renewal. It's one of the great things about our democracy. But one of the liabilities is that we tend to be very bad at recalling lessons, mistakes, and insights from the past. It's that simple, right? There was actually an academic study by a couple of professors about 6-7 years ago in which they surveyed 600 current and former senior government officials, and they asked, what is the most useful thing that you can get from academia? And the answer was basically historical case studies with clear application to current policy. That was it. I mean, it kind of sucks for all the non-historians and non-political scientists out there, but you know, they know the game they're getting into, and it's very straightforward. So recall the lessons, the insights, and the mistakes of the past, especially in the policy world. All right. That is my introduction. See, I told you I was going to be very bad at predicting the length of this thing, but I think we're okay. I think we're pretty flexible this morning. So who are the Russians in my view? I get this question all the time. I rarely have time to really answer it. I tend, you know, Fyodor and I were talking about this, sort of educating my mom at the dinner table last night. I really believe, and I hope Fyodor shares this view, I think Russians and Americans are incredibly similar. I think far more similar than popular culture and certainly than politics ever gives us credit for, where we tend to be portrayed as some type of diametric opposites. So in actual fact, we are uniquely both Atlantic and Pacific peoples, right? I mean, that is a very unusual thing to be a continental nation. More importantly, we're both nations that have been shaped by that experience, by expansion across a vast, ostensibly unsettled continental territory, except in our case, it's manifest destiny expansion to here to the shining Pacific. And in Russia's case, it's the endless vast expanse of Siberia. And in fact, there's a direct connection to my institution, the Kennan Institute, which is named not, as you might think, for George F. Kennan, but at George F. Kennan's insistence, it is named for his elder relative, George Kennan the Elder, who lived in the mid and late 19th century, and was one of the first American explorers of the Russian Far East and Far Eastern Siberia. And so his kind of entry point to the experience of Russia was not, like so many Americans, through Europe and the West. It was actually across the Bering Strait, landing, I believe, in Kamchatka, in Petropavlovsk, and then exploring the coastline up to and down to Vladivostok. We are both countries, we're both civilizations, if you will, that cast ourselves as being saviors. The Russian story, right, we've heard it so many times, you know, saving Western civilization from Napoleon, right, from itself, from Hitler. And then, of course, the American, what is the line? I think it happens to be uttered. See, this is a generational cultural reference. It happens to be uttered by Willie, the Scottish groundskeeper in The Simpsons, about the cheese-eating surrender monkeys, right? I mean, so, but that's really an American sentiment more than anything, that we go over there and we save Europe, where much of our civilization has its sort of cultural, intellectual origins, but we save them from themselves and their own dysfunction and their wars. And of course, our politics tends to be this kind of cyclical reaction to, you know, having to have these international obligations and then retrenching back into kind of Fortress America. But I think even more so, we are both civilizations that feel we have a mission. And that have always felt that way, and that when we don't know what our mission is, when, for instance, Russians in the 1990s are not sure what the Russian project is, how to define the Russian nation. In fact, I think Boris Yeltsin even held a competition to define what was the Russian national idea. Or when we Americans are struggling with that domestically, politically, we tend to be in a lot of trouble. But when Russians are comfortably situated in their self-image as the third Rome, right, as the heirs to Byzantium and to Rome before it, or when Americans are comfortably situated in our origins with the founding fathers, the city on a hill, the freedom agenda, whatever it may be, we tend to feel the happiest and the most self-actualized. One of the most interesting narratives for a lot of Americans is the way that Russians talk about having saved the world from communism, right? This is something that Americans just say, what? No, we saved the world from communism. And of course, many Russians will tell you, no, actually, we're the ones who bore that particular cross, no pun intended. We tried it out, we proved it didn't work, and then we rejected it, right? And it was that rejection that was sort of the beginning of the end of communism as a valid idea for organizing human life. So is there a values gap that is the main driver of U.S.-Russian conflict? I tend to think not. I think what there is a difference of sort of sequence and of emphasis and, if you will, of punctuation. And the catchphrase is, just remember, let's eat, comma, grandma versus take the comma out, right? Or, you know, eats, shoots, and leaves. You guys know these are jokes. You're supposed to be laughing right now. It's early, I understand. I'm your warm-up act, Fyodor. You're very lucky. But the idea is emphasis, sequence, punctuation, the little details of the differences between our values and our worldview matter enormously, because these are the things ultimately that determine our positions on important international issues. So if I were to give you kind of a Cliff's Notes guide to the values that matter for ordinary Russians, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this explicitly from my perspective as an American observer of Russia. And I invite Fyodor to utechnit this list and comment as you will. But in my view, the order and the sequence here matters very much. So number one would be, and this is, by the way, this is step one. This is that empathy exercise. So as you go through this with me, channel your own experience and think about how you might apply these ideas, whether you agree with them or not. Number one is to live decently. I would call it zhit dostoyno, would be sort of my Russian notion of that. Stability, prosperity, basic freedoms, and by almost any of these measures, right, number one, paramount, most important thing, life is much better in Russia today, not just than in Soviet times, but ever. Better than the 1990s for sure, you know, certainly better than imperial times, better than it's ever been in Russia. Now, of course, the country has a long way to go on modernization and development. But if you say to yourself that the number one priority, and I don't think this is radically different for Americans, right? What do Americans, most Americans, think about when they get up in the morning? Do they think about liberating, you know, Mosul? No. They think about, you know, have I got a decent day ahead of me? Can I feed my kids? Can I put gas in the car? You know, can I pay my absurd California water bill and keep my lawn green? Right? Living decently, stability, prosperity, basic freedoms. That's number one. And again, sequence, punctuation matters very much here. Number two, to be Russian. This is one we almost never think about because we take being American for granted, but we never think about what it means to be Russian to a Russian. Russia is a great world civilization. I've given you a bazillion examples of that. It's clearly not exclusive of being Western or being European, even though I think from time to time that is a raging debate in Russia. But I think fundamentally, objectively, that is something that can coexist very easily. But it is distinct. It is distinct, and it's the distinctions that need to be appreciated in order for Russians to be Russian. Russia has to be respected. It has to be appreciated. And I think what rankles with Russians more than anything is when Western criticism is not just criticism, but takes the tone of dismissiveness or disregard, right? As if there is nothing of importance there. In other words, agree or disagree. You can disagree, but you have to acknowledge the importantness or the importance to Russians of what it is that makes them them, what they have achieved, what they have contributed to the world, even if you dislike it, right? You can say, we think your science is all completely wrong, but we understand how it's played an important role in shaping the history of world scientific research. And then finally, and again, I think that the sequence matters here. This may surprise you. I think Russians really do value freedom. I think you could almost define a Russian freedom agenda. It would look different than an American freedom agenda. Within this category of valuing freedom, I think Russians tend to value personal freedoms higher than political freedoms. And that maybe, I'm not totally sure about this because I don't necessarily know my own society that well, but it may be a reversal of the way Americans think. Certainly when political Americans ask, is Russia a free country, right? When Freedom House does its rankings, they pretty much rank political freedoms, right? Are you free to go out in the street and protest against your government? Are you free to organize a political party, you know, in opposition to your government? Are you free, whatever, right? To speak ill of your president, to threaten violence, all of these things. Russians tend to value things like freedom of travel, freedom of speech, freedom of religion. All freedoms, by the way, don't forget, they didn't have in Soviet times. And this was one of the really big impetuses for Soviet protest against the regime, that they couldn't travel where they wanted. Well, Russians go all over the world today, including this country, if we let them in. But they go to Turkey, they go to Egypt, they go to Cuba, they go to places where we don't actually get to go and to the places where we do go. And they love it. They absolutely live for this freedom of travel. They're free to speak by and large in almost any context, up to and including shouting their views on the streets. You know, what they're not free to do or where they encounter limitations is in organizing explicit political movements with a desire to change the state. And we're going to talk more, a lot more, in this masterclass about Russian notions of statehood and why those are so sacred. And they are free. And this is really important, right? Again, Americans, ironically, I think we tend to be a pretty religious society, Americans, but there is a pretty big divide, I think, between a kind of religious core in our country and a sort of, you know, not to get into American politics, but a kind of influential urban coastal elite, which is not particularly religious. And so we tend to appreciate less the religiosity that is resident in Russian society. In fact, it's incredibly powerful. It was another major driver for protest against the Soviet Union. And the fact that Russians are basically, with some important exceptions, totally free to practice the religion that they want to practice today is very important to them. All right. That's sort of ordinary Russians. But there are important distinctions between that and the Russian political elite, and in particular the political elite, which has been dominant and ascendant since 1991. I think the overarching worldview for the folks, broadly speaking, in and around the Kremlin today is that the world's a complex and essentially dangerous place. You know, I think the metaphor is, again, generational reference. You know, when Frodo puts on the ring in Lord of the Rings, right, and the world goes all kind of gray and scary and woo, there's spirits flying around, right? Like, that is what the empathy exercise would give you if you try to think about how the world looks from the standpoint of, you know, an elite Russian decision maker of a certain generation. And the generations are important because, number one, think about folks who are, broadly speaking, somewhere between your age and maybe mine, maybe a little bit older, in 1989 and 1991, right? These are folks, they were not kids, they were not sheltered by their parents and their grandparents. They were not retired, right, living off the fruits of what they'd achieved. They were just entering the ascent phase, the boost phase, if you will, of their career, where they had invested a ton, they had worked really hard, and they were ready to achieve status and recognition and financial compensation and service, right? You know, proudly wearing the uniforms that they had earned a right to wear. And then what happens? Everything disappears, right? And not just in the sense of, like, you know, a change of regime, a change of leadership, literally everything from the salary to the symbol on the uniform to the physical place that they thought they were going to be representing, defending, living in, whatever, to the retirement system, pension, everything disappears. Everything they thought they had earned after something like 2, 3, 4 decades is instantly gone. Now, again, I can't read minds, but what effect do you think that would have on someone's psychology and worldview if that is the single biggest formative experience that they have at this point in their life and career? And those are exactly the people who are now making the key decisions about Russian domestic and foreign policy in and around the Kremlin. Incredibly important thing to understand. Why does this tie into the U.S.-Russia relationship? Well, for many obvious reasons, but the most important of which is that many of them carry with them a sense that the U.S. perspective and the broader Western perspective on what they had experienced was complete indifference, if not schadenfreude. That we were actually happy that it was happening, and we thought that they deserved it because this particular group, right, this elite group, which had earned the uniforms and the rank and the privilege, they were the bad guys, and they were supposed to have lost. And so if they think that we feel that way about an experience which is incredibly traumatic to them, right, and we hear Mr. Putin talk about this, you know, the tragedy of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and we think that they deserved it, they should have lost, and they are somehow the bad guys, how do you think they tend to look at us and our role in this dangerous, uncertain world? Now, this sense of uncertainty, complication, and sort of basically negative trend lines is reinforced by a dependency, as we know very well, on energy and commodity prices for the state budget. What is the one thing we can say about energy prices with certainty? We can't say if they're going to go up, we can't say if they're going to go down, but we can say that they're going to fluctuate, and we can say that they're going to be unpredictable. And so if your budget depends primarily on those commodities, on those prices, by definition, your budget's going to be unpredictable. And that means everything you can do, everything you can pay for domestically, social services, infrastructure, everything you can do in foreign policy, military spending, is going to have a big element of unpredictability to it. And then thirdly, I mentioned this a little bit earlier, and again, we'll talk much, much more about this, the edifice of the state itself, right? The state, государственность, stateness, the sort of thickness of the idea of the state in Russian society. The story that matters to these folks is that in the 1990s, the state was weakened. The state, right? Not the people, not the nation. The state was weakened. It was on its back or it was on its knees, depending on how you want to tell the story. And that Russia's recovery, the story of, broadly speaking, sort of the late 90s until today, has been a story about restoration and recovery of the Russian state. It's critical to understand this as distinct from of individual Russian people. As a result, the state is as central to Russian life, and in particular to Russian politics and Russian society, as it has ever been in Russian history. Now, what that does is it eliminates or it precludes the element of what I would almost call portfolio theory, right? So the more estates, to use the sort of semi-historical, semi-political science terms, the more estates you have in society within which some type of political, organizational, financial power resides, the more pluralism you have, right? The more fallbacks you have in case something doesn't work out with one of them. So imagine like a Hurricane Katrina scenario, right? Local government is completely overwhelmed. Well, you've got federal government. Well, you've got church groups. Well, you've got companies, right? All of which step in. In the Russian system that these folks have built, it is a vertical of power. And all important authorities reside within the state or answer to the state. And this gives rise, and again, back to the sense of unpredictability of sort of the scariness of the world, this gives rise to a sense of brittleness and understanding. These people are not stupid. They understand that if there's a crack, if there's a wobble in this pillar of stateness, everything else goes with it. There is not a sense of portfolio theory. Oh, we can just, for a while, we can just abdicate on the political front because you know what, like we're going through a tough time. Like here in America, right? A lot of people say that. How many people say that and presume that that means the end of America as we know it, right? And I mean that in a real sense, not in like a hyperbolic, you know, New Republic article headline sense. Not many people think that. Most of us assume the trash is still going to be picked up. Our kids are still going to be educated. Things are still going to be fine because actually probably they are. But this is very different than the way these folks see the world. This tends to give rise to a way of thinking about Russia in the world, which is very transactional. Because if you exist in an uncertain environment, it doesn't make sense to build for the long term. And more importantly, there is a recognition that Russia is far from the most powerful actor on the world stage. I know Fyodor is going to talk a lot more about this in the concept of polycentricity, which MMO has done a lot of work on. But the idea that these folks tend to pursue is making deals. It makes a lot of sense to make deals, and they like to make deals, and they especially like to make deals with us, by the way, with the United States, with Europe. But they're never going to do so in sacrifice of what they call Russia's independent foreign policy, right? It's never going to be, we will pay you in order to have the privilege to make a deal with you, right? Because if they've done that, what are they doing? They're sacrificing this statehood. This thing that is absolutely central to their survival as they view it. They also recognize that they don't get to dictate terms. They're not going to be China's senior partner. They're not going to be anyone's older brother. And they tend to appreciate being kind of a broker, kind of a middleman in many cases. Like, for example, the Iran nuclear deal, again, where Russia's participation doesn't guarantee a successful outcome. And yet it's very clear that without Russia, a successful outcome is not possible. And we hear that trope over and over, of course, Syria, Ukraine, maybe North Korea. And then lastly, they tend to believe that Russia, at least relative to the United States, is a uniquely rational actor. Right, that they see the world, and again, this does go kind of back to the traumatic experience of the 1990s. They see the world as it is, whereas we imagine the world to be something that it is not, and we imagine outcomes that are simply not possible. So, for instance, on human rights, they ask, you know, why are we utterly obsessed with human rights in Russia? So much so that, you know, the Pussy Riot girls or the Greenpeace protesters, whoever become cause celebs, Sergei Magnitsky, that completely reshape American perceptions of Russia. And yet you can have millions of women, you know, living in portable cages in Saudi Arabia, and that means nothing to us. We literally do not remark on this except once in a blue moon. Why are we, for example, obsessed with Iran's nuclear program? And I want to be clear, these are not necessarily my views, but this is the sense, you know, Russians could give you an endless list of ways in which they view us to be irrational in expressing our own interests, in particular our own global interests. Why are we obsessed with Iran's nuclear program? Pakistan goes nuclear, and it's barely a blip for American foreign policy, right? I mean, that's an exaggeration, but again, this is the point. In Pakistan, let's not forget, Iran, relatively speaking, a somewhat stable government. Pakistan, you know, there are extremists in the Pakistani ISI who are pretty much ready to turn it into the next Taliban state. Why are we absolutely fine or apparently fine with the radical nationalists of countries like Poland or Hungary or Ukraine or the Baltic states? And yet, you know, any hint of nationalism, even the slightest whiff of nationalism in Russia, and we start making movies about, you know, what was that one? The Saint, you know, with Val Kilmer. Okay, that's a generational thing, I think. But anyway, he played Batman, guys. He's cool. You know, and the idea that Russian nationalism is a threat to the entire world, but something like Polish nationalism, which actually historically at one point did conquer much of the known European world, at least, that's not a problem. In fact, I once did a fellowship, a NATO Defense College fellowship, and I remember the commanding general of the college, the commandant, was a Polish Air Force officer who had, of course, being a general of a certain generation, had actually studied at the Frunze Academy in Moscow, right? So he's a Soviet-trained Polish general, and he had a suit of armor in his office at the NATO Defense College of a flying hussar. You know, these guys, the sort of Polish armored knight with the big feathers behind them, right? You know, these guys. If you're a Ukrainian or a Russian or pretty much anybody that the Poles fought with during that time, you do not like that image. That is a very, very bad image for you. I'm not going to declare any, you know, metaphors here, but suffice to say that was not appreciated by many of the visiting folks from the former Soviet space. Okay. Why does Russia matter, right? Why do Americans have to take this country, which is admittedly not the most important or powerful country in the world, which has such a complicated sense of itself, is so prickly and difficult to deal with? Well, you know, why do we even have to bother? Okay, well, you know, answer number one is always going to be the same, and being right here in proximity to CNS, Bill's institution, it's nukes, right? This is literally the only existential threat, or at least immediate existential threat, to life as we know it in the United States. It is the first or second largest nuclear power. It's also the second largest supplier of conventional weapons in the world, after the United States, of course. It's a swing vote on the UN Security Council. We saw that with, of course, famously with the Libya bombing, where Russia chose not to exercise its veto, but with Iran sanctions, and then recently with North Korea, where it did exercise it again, or said it would exercise it. But here's the thing, right? So that's very irritating if you're an American who wants to just, you know, get business done at the UN Security Council or in any of these international bodies. And yet, if you're an American who says or who thinks that institutions matter and that international law matters, here's the thing. Russia's always going to be a part of that. You can't have international institutions and you can't have international law without Russian participation. It's just not going to be legitimate. So the fantasies of those who sit around designing things like the League of Democracies and whatever, that will always remain fantasy. Because if you exclude the Russias and the Chinas of the world, then you really don't have international law. What you have is, you know, Pax Americana or Pax, however you say Western. And I don't speak any Latin languages. It's a real problem in California. I never learned Spanish, you know, Russian, German, and Hebrew, which are almost utterly useless outside of the three countries. And even in all the Germans speak perfect English. It's so frustrating. I studied German for 7 years. I never get to use it. Sorry, if any of you want to study German, I don't want to discourage you. But resolving regional conflicts, right? I mentioned this before. Ukraine, Israel, Palestine, North Korea. If you think about the sort of official formats for each of these conflicts, by definition, Russia's at the table. And again, it's one of these necessary but not sufficient things, right? Just because Americans and Russians sit down doesn't mean we're resolving any of these issues. But if you don't sit down with Russians at the table on these issues, you're not resolving them, guaranteed. 21st century challenges. This is very interesting. Russia is a country that in many ways punches above its weight, but in particular on these kind of global challenge issues. When you think about Russia, not just a Soviet legacy, but as a country which thinks of itself as having a global role, that manifests itself in an ability to project. We tend to think about military power, but think also about disaster relief capabilities, global detection capabilities for nuclear testing, for pandemic disease, medical rescue capabilities, right? Naval capabilities, again, not just warships, but the ability to do pirate interdiction, right? Refugee rescue, Arctic capabilities to ensure safe and free passage, things like that. Russia is a country that more than simply the accident of its geography being physically the largest country on Earth, because of its ambition, the scale and scope of its desire to be a global actor, when you talk about 21st century global challenges, you always have to talk about Russia. Russian capabilities are going to be on the table. And if you compare it to countries that have, for example, comparable GDPs or comparable populations, compare it, to Brazil, for example, Brazil doesn't have anything near that level of global capability to deal with 21st century challenges. Right? Maybe it will in the future. Maybe in 50 years, Brazil will be there. It's not there today, and Russia is. I mentioned, of course, it's the biggest country on Earth. I remember this wonderful exchange when President Obama referred dismissively to Russia as a smaller and weaker country, merely a regional power. And Ambassador Sergei Kislyak, who's finally, I think, headed home after a pretty rough home stretch of his 10-year service in Washington. You all know who he is. If I was doing this lecture with slides, I'd have like a little picture of the two of us sitting together. I was on television constantly being like, man, I see this guy like every week. As far as I know, he's a diplomat, but who knows? His rejoinder to this was fantastic. He said on television, well, we agree that Russia is a regional power as long as we define that region as stretching from the Sea of Japan to the Baltic and from the Arctic to the Middle East. So yes, that is basically correct. It's also like two-thirds of the known world. So yes, Russia is a regional power. Russia's environment, forests, fresh water, Lake Baikal has 20% of the world's unfrozen fresh water alone, right? In an era of possibly man-made climate change, carbon emissions. I don't have to tell you about the importance of Siberian forests. And then, of course, energy, right? We hear a lot about this. Although the numbers are declining, a lot of European countries are still overwhelmingly dependent on Russian energy export. China is increasingly taking Russian gas. In global LNG markets, energy is fungible. We can talk more about that. But nonetheless, Russia is a very, very, very big actor. And that is also a big actor in oil prices, which is why this recent deal between Russia and OPEC, Russia has assiduously avoided being a member of OPEC. But nonetheless, if Russia and OPEC sit down at the table, you better believe energy analysts around the planet are watching very, very carefully for puffs of white smoke. And then Arctic, right? And this may be, with climate change, an increasingly important world region. Certainly it will be for energy exports from the region, which will be increasingly accessible. It may be for transit across the region, although some people argue that that's a fantasy. But there will be security, environmental, humanitarian, all kinds of issues around the Arctic, and Russia is the single biggest stakeholder. It is also the most capable stakeholder, right, with something like 30 icebreakers to the two that the United States has, one of which is out of service at any given time. And then the size of the Russian market, just the economic factor. Yes, it's true that Russia has suffered GDP decline in the last couple of years. That seems to be turning around. Depending on how you measure GDP, it's either just outside the top 10 in the world, or it's just inside the top 10, depending on whether you use purchasing power parity. We're talking about 145 million consumers, who, by the way, like to buy American products as a general rule. That may be changing, but it has historically been the case for about 3 or 4 years running, I think, between 2007 and 2011, Ford was the best-selling foreign automobile brand in Russia, and most Fords sold in Russia are now made in Russia. Pretty good deal for the United States. We just kind of sit back and watch the profits roll in while Russians make and buy Fords. Plenty of other stories. Boeing has done upwards of $50 billion in aircraft sales. Pepsi acquired Wimbledon, which was a big Russian drink producer, for $5.5 billion. Of course, ExxonMobil has invested massively in oil drilling in the Russian Arctic, now frozen thanks to sanctions. Russia's foreign currency reserves, although substantially depleted as a result of the previous crisis and the most recent low energy crisis and sanctions driven crisis, is nonetheless among the world's largest, right? It's in the hundreds of billions. There are a lot of intricacies with how you measure that. So the Russian economy, but fair enough, you know, I put this last on my list because at the end of the day, it is true that U.S.-Russian bilateral trade is down to about $20 billion. I'd love to have $20 billion. That sounds like a lot of money, but at the end of the day, that's less than 0.5% of total U.S. bilateral trade with the rest of the world. So it's not very much. All right. I want to ask and lay out a framework of a question, and then what I might do is actually maybe skip the recommendations in the interest of time to get you to Fyodor's lecture. But I want to lay out my thinking about this question about, are we in a new Cold War? Because Fyodor is going to address that in much more detail. So the answer, of course, is yes and no. There are ways in which the current period is similar to a Cold War. Though note, I don't say the Cold War, because I think it is a very distinct historical phenomenon, which Fyodor will talk more about. What are the similarities? Number one, a shift in rhetoric. We see high levels of propaganda on both sides, high levels of mutual demonization, sort of the boogeymanization of one another. And a narrative that the other is solely at fault for provoking the conflict. How often in the American media, and one could ask the exact same about the Russian media, how often do you hear an acknowledgement of the role that our own side has played in provoking or exacerbating the conflict? Almost never. Almost never. All you hear is a litany of grievances, a sequence of events wherein the other side has produced the current impasse. And the impasse exists because of the other side's intransigence. As a result, we have extremely low expectations of one another, and we tend to impose tit-for-tat punishments. So sanctions and counter-sanctions, freezing of the institutions that we have created specifically to manage the relationship. This is a real tragedy for those of us who have worked really hard on building up those institutions over the years. We had a bilateral presidential commission, which itself was a baby that had been thrown out, by the way, with the bathwater over and over. We had such commissions going all the way back to the 1970s, and every time relations soured, somehow flipping over the chessboard and saying, nah, I don't want to play with you, I don't want to talk to you, seemed like a good idea at the time. It has never been a good idea. The NATO-Russia Council, why did we create the NATO-Russia Council? So that NATO and Russia could talk to each other. Well, things get bad, we shut down the NATO-Russia Council. Brilliant idea, right? I remember this unique moment about a year ago where you had an American astronaut and a Russian cosmonaut living in space together for a year in the International Space Station. And it blew my mind that that was at exactly the moment where the U.S. government had declared that all bilateral contacts at a working level with Russians should stop. And the question in my mind was, is this going to become like a real-life version of The Martian, where these two guys are literally going to be stranded in the space station together because the guys on the ground won't talk to each other, and they're going to have to start like making their own food out of, I don't know, radiator parts or something. Luckily, they're back safely down on Earth now, and now we can, you know, safely go off in a huff and not talk to each other anymore. Now, we are still doing, thankfully, the NASA Roscosmos work. You know, but the exceptions are very limited, right? We have space, the Iran nuclear deal, and basically the Arctic Council. And in everything else, we stop talking to each other. Russian and American officials are not allowed to speak. And then proxy conflicts, right? Very reminiscent of a Cold War. The alignment of international players behind one side or the other side, and then local actors who receive material, political, or in some cases actual direct boots on the ground or aircraft in the sky, military support. So you have Ukraine, the Donbass conflict, Georgia versus South Ossetia and Abkhazia, Syria, the Assad regime and their forces versus the so-called moderate rebels. And then you even have kind of non-militarized proxy wars between Russia and the West, fights for influence in places as diverse as Belarus and Kazakhstan, but also Greece, Hungary, Venezuela, even France and Germany. And this is often described now in the Western press as sort of hybrid war, information war. But these are proxy conflicts. That's the important thing to understand. They're conflicts which are taking place not in our society or in the Russian society, but in third country societies. But they're essentially conflicts between our interests and Russia's. So those are similarities. Those are troubling. They should be troubling. Here's the problem. The problem is that the differences, in my view, are in some ways even more troubling. But I'll start with a little good news. The good news is we're definitely coming out of an unprecedented period of Russian global engagement and of engagement between the USA and Russia. So if you think about the Cold War, Russia was very much of a closed society. That has not been the case at all for the last 25 years. And certainly connectivity between Russia and the United States is higher than it has ever been, despite the shutdown of these official channels. Post-Soviet Russia, of course, much freer than the Soviet Union. I talked about that in terms of personal freedom. I mean, all you have to do is look at, you know, any of our Facebook pages or Adna Klasniki if you're on there, and just see the number of foreigners on there to see how interconnected this generation is. There's obviously no global ideological struggle in the current conflict. I mean, we basically agree if somehow it was miraculously possible for Russian and American parliamentarians, elected officials, to sit down with one another and kind of go through a list of sort of basic campaign points. Do we agree or disagree? They would probably agree about 90% of things. They campaign on exactly the same messages to their people that we campaign to our people. We agree on free markets. We have disputes about the sort of the features of democracy, right? What type of electoral process is appropriate, what type of constitutionalism, and certainly we have geopolitical differences. But there's not really, Russians are not out there right now today selling a kind of global, all-encompassing ideology like Bolshevik communism that says this is the solution to all of your problems. They're simply not. And Americans, quite honestly, have retreated quite far from the position that we were in during the Cold War of selling free market capitalism as the solution to all of our problems. So that ideological struggle has really receded. But what's troubling is that there's also a massive power imbalance between Russia and the West. You might say, well, that's a great thing, right? The United States is ascendant, is very powerful. That allows us to, you know, get basically what we want. Well, there are limits to that. Most importantly, we are coming off of about a quarter century of being an unrivaled hyperpower. What that means is we're really not in the habit of taking others' interests into account in any way. Again, back to this issue of empathy. If you look at the U.S. GDP at the height of the Cold War in 1980, it was about $3 trillion. The Soviet GDP, which was, of course, largely non-monetized, so very difficult to measure, was about $1.5 trillion. So the U.S. GDP was still bigger in monetary terms, but they were in the same league, you might say. In 2013, and I think today it's much higher, the U.S. GDP was $17 trillion and Russia's was $2 trillion. And Russia's is now lower in monetary terms because of the recent economic decline. So you're talking about an order of magnitude difference. Militarily, NATO versus the Warsaw Pact. During the Cold War, there was sort of rough equality, or at least balance. Today, NATO versus Russia and its allies, probably Belarus is the only one that could fairly be called an ally. Again, order of magnitude difference in terms of numbers of troops that can be fielded, tanks, artillery material, etc. What all of this gives rise to is a low perceived threat of escalation to direct confrontation, military conflict between the two sides. And why does that matter? That's a difference. That's a big difference from the Cold War. During the Cold War, the perceived threat of escalation was ever present and very high. And this makes an enormous difference because it means we no longer have rational fear. Ask yourself honestly. I mean, and this should be an exceptional group, but ask yourself honestly, you wake up in the morning, how much do you really think about the possibility of war with Russia? Probably not at all. That was really different during the Cold War. The problem is we lack that motivation, that impulse that says, if this is a real threat, then it threatens all of those things that I care about in my life. Sending my kids to school, putting gas in my car, watering my lawn. We better deal with this thing. This should be a priority. That element is missing, and that is the single biggest problem. So, very quickly, I want to say a word about what we can do about it, and then I'll turn the floor over to Fyodor. Number one, know something about Russia. To channel George Kennan just a little bit, you can't do containment or engagement or whatever policy you want to do if you don't know your interlocutor. Cuts to U.S. government expertise, infrastructure on Russia have been very substantial, like over 80% of the funding that was dedicated during the Cold War to studying Russia and the region has been eliminated, and it doesn't seem like we're on course to restore that. Don't try to change Russia, right? If your policy is to change Russia, that's kind of as dumb as, you know, getting married on the theory that you're going to change the other person, right? I mean, that's like a class that never, ever works. Efforts to change Russia have always backfired from the 90s and the 2000s to vice versa, by the way. I here submit that if, in fact, the Russians have been attempting to change America by intervening in our domestic politics, I 100% guarantee you, 100%, that it has and will backfire. Instead, try to change incentives, right? If you want to deter bad behavior, think about what the appropriate punishment should be for that bad behavior. If you want to incentivize positive behavior, what positive offers can you make? What incentives can you offer? Sanctions and pressure. If you want to take the stick approach along with the carrot, it depends on leverage, right? The Archimedes ostensibly said, give me a long enough lever and a place to stand and I can move the universe, right? Well, you got to have a place to stand. And the problem we have now increasingly is all we do is the stick. All we do are sanctions, which has eroded the economic, political, social, people-to-people relationship so much that we Americans don't have a place to stand. There is no relationship there. There's no basis for us to exercise leverage on Russia anymore. You can only do sanctions if you're doing trade in the first place, right? And so as a result, we try to project our sanctions onto the Europeans. They do have a place to stand. But that is also eroding, right? We're encouraging the Europeans to do less energy trade with the Russians, to do less finance with the Russians. So increasingly, they also won't have a place to stand. And so in the end, you know, Russia and China will have an economic relationship. The Chinese have no interest in doing sanctions, and we will have no place to stand and no way of influencing Russia at all. Of course, we've got to fix the weak institutional foundations. I talked about, you know, throwing the baby out with the bathwater or the bilateral presidential commission, trade, travel, preserving the basic visa agreements that we have in place today. You know, my nightmare, the nightmare I wake up with as a head of a Russian studies institute is that the visa agreements are going to be canceled, because that's only going to punish. That is a wonderful way of punishing one another's best friends. We're amazing at that, by the way, because the only people we have access to are good Russians, right? Russians who want to come here and talk to us and engage with us and teach us about Russians. These are the people that we punish, right? And the Russians do the same thing, by the way, right? They're punishing me. I'm the guy that they choose to, you know, depict as the American, right? They attack me in the press, or they give me a hard time at the border crossing. This is idiocy, right? But we're doing this on both sides. We got to talk to each other about the hard issues, right? Not just looking for good conversations. It's very tempting in politics to set up an agenda so that you only talk about things that you know are going to be successful. But you do that over and over for decades, and you guarantee that the relationship is going to fall into a pit at some point. And that's where we are, right? We avoided the difficult issues for long enough that we got ourselves into a real conflict now. And then lastly, I've skipped a lot of stuff here, but lastly, I think the most effective way to solve the problems that we Americans believe that we face now, both at home and internationally, is to go back to Kennan's wisdom and think about what our positive vision is. I talked about kind of the retreat of American ideology on the world stage. Kennan wrote all of the following in 1946, and I want to end on this quote, but ask yourself as I read this to you, ask yourself how much of this would be equally true today and is completely applicable today. Kennan wrote in 1946, "We must formulate and put forward for other nations a much more positive and constructive picture of the sort of world we would like them to see than we have put forward in the past. Europeans are tired and frightened by the experiences of the past and are less interested in abstract freedom than in security. It's about the degree to which the United States can create among the peoples of the world generally the impression of a country which knows what it wants, which is coping successfully with the problems of its internal life and with the responsibilities of a world power, and which has a spiritual vitality capable of holding its own among the major ideological currents of the time. Surely," he concludes, "there was never a fairer test of national quality than this. In the light of these circumstances, the thoughtful observer of Russian-American relations will find no cause for complaint in the Kremlin's challenge to American society." Every word of that, I think, applies perfectly well today. Thanks.